lit picture window fronting the house. From his cloaked position in the yard, Carl observed a man emerge from a path that bordered the canal across the street. The man was ambling along but stopped short when his eyes locked on something. Carl followed his absorbed gaze to the window, where Glenda, dressed in a halter top and shorts, was talking with her mother in the living room. The man dropped to his hands and knees. Carl had been at Glenda's when she spotted the prowler outside her bedroom. He'd chased him into a neighbor's yard before losing him in the dark. He knew he was looking at the same man. Even knowing that couldn't prepare him for what happened next. On his hands and knees, as if magnetized by what he saw in the window, the man began a military-style crawl toward Glenda's house. Carl remained still and obscured in the dark. He let the man snake his way to the front hedges. He clearly had no idea Carl was there. Achieving maximum shock effect meant choosing the precise moment to speak. Carl waited until the man had risen slightly and was peeking over the hedges into the window. "What are you doing here?" Carl shouted. The man recoiled in shock. He screamed something unintelligible and took off in a panicked, almost vaudevillian run. Glenda had described her prowler as chubby. He was on the heavy side, Carl confirmed, with sloping shoulders and big legs. He ran awkwardly and not particularly fast. The chase ended abruptly when the man cut to the left and ducked into a neighbor's alcove that was screened on one side. Carl planted himself in front of the alcove, blocking the way. The man was trapped. Street lighting gave Carl a chance to observe his girlfriend's prowler up close. He was about 5'10", 180 to 190 pounds, with short, fat legs and stubby arms. His hair was blonde, combed over, and stringy. He had a button nose. The ears were short and fleshy, his eyes squinty. His lower lip pushed out a little bit. His face was round and expressionless. "What were you doing looking in my girlfriend's window?" Carl asked. The man looked away. "Well, Ben, it looks like the guy's got us here," he said loudly, excitedly, as if calling to an accomplice off to the side. There was no one there. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" Carl asked. Getting no answer, Carl moved closer. "Leave me alone," the man said. "Go away." His speech was slow and dull now, with a hint of an oaky accent. Carl took another step forward. The man responded by sticking his hand in his pocket. He was wearing a brown cotton jacket with woven cuffs. It was a style that had been popular years earlier, but had since gone out of fashion. "Leave me alone," he repeated flatly. "Go away." Carl noticed a bulge in the pocket where the man's hand was. The detail took a split second to compute. When it did, Carl's instincts ordered him to stand back. It was the strangest, most unsettling sense, glimpsing for a moment the dark circuitry at work behind the dull-eyed mask. The round-faced simpleton in unfashionable clothes with the flat voice of an oaky bumpkin was, as evidenced by the move for what was most certainly a concealed gun, someone else altogether. Carl stepped aside. He noticed when the man passed him that his face was pale and unusually smooth. Carl felt certain that he was at least 25 years old, but oddly, for someone who had, as they might say in Visalia, reached his majority, it didn't appear he could even shave. Carl watched the man walk north up Sowell Street. He kept swiveling around every few seconds to make certain Carl wasn't following him. Even then, with jittery body language of suspicion and fear, the man's pale, round face remained inert, smooth, and blank as an egg. Even further back, in September of 1973, Fran Cleary, pseudonym, had a strange encounter in front of her West Cahuilla Avenue home. As she was getting into her car, she heard a noise and looked up, spotting a man with light blonde hair and a smooth, round face emerging from her backyard. As he jogged into the street, he noticed Cleary and did an about-face, yelling out, "Catch you later, Sandy!" before jogging northbound onto a perpendicular road and disappearing from view. Fran told her 15-year-old daughter Sherry, not her real name, about the incident, and Sherry revealed that she'd seen someone matching the same description peeping into her bedroom window a week earlier. The prowler would pester them for 2 months, visiting the residence one last time in October. From 1973 through early 1976, numerous other teenaged and young adult women in the neighborhood had run-ins with a window peeper who fit the same description. But once the composite sketch based on Bill McGowan's run-in with the ransacker was released to the local press in mid-December 1976, he never struck Visalia again. And yet, the ransacker investigation barreled on full tilt. For an unsolved serial case to advance, it needs to go back. Early reports are pored over, hindsight wielded like a magnifying glass. Victims and eyewitnesses are recontacted. Dulled memories sometimes sharpen. Occasionally, an overlooked clue shakes loose. Someone will remember an incident that wasn't necessarily officially reported. They'll have a name, but not a number. Calls are made. Visalia detectives in contact with Sacramento authorities in 1977 noted at least a dozen similarities between the two offenders. Among them, both offenders ransacked. Both stole trinkets and personalized jewelry while leaving items of greater value behind. Both employed a similar manner of approach, climbing astride their sleeping victims and placing a hand over their mouths. Both used household items to create a makeshift alarm system. Both used a similar breaking and entering method, using a pry tool to chip around a door jamb and bypass the striker plate. Both hopped fences. Both were about 5'9". Both removed purses from inside the residence and dumped the contents outside. It was a compelling list. Visalia investigators thought they were onto something. Sacramento County Sheriff's personnel compared the two series and saw unsurmountable differences. For starters, 6 of 9 MO factors didn't match. The shoe impressions differed. The shoe sizes even differed. The ear didn't steal blue chip stamps. And the physical descriptions were fundamentally different. After all, descriptions of the ransacker pointed to a highly distinctive appearance, an outsized baby with stubby limbs and fingers and a smooth, pale complexion. The ear was described as anywhere from medium to slight build, with one victim going so far as to call him puny. In the summer months, he appeared tanned. Even if the ransacker had lost weight, it seemed unlikely he was a shapeshifter. Visalia disagreed and went to the press. In July 1978, the Sacramento Union published an article in which the possibility of a link was promoted, and the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department was criticized for its closed-mindedness. The following day, the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department struck back in the press, denouncing the union for irresponsible journalism and accusing the Visalia Police Department of publicity-seeking and desperation. The Sacramento City Police Department, however, remained open to the possibility of a connection. Richard Shelby occasionally mined the avenue, too. The Sacramento Sheriff's Department asked local utility companies for lists of employees who had transferred from the Visalia area between December 1975 and April 1976. They found two. Both were subsequently eliminated. 40 years later, official opinion is still divided, though more amiably so. Ken Clark, Sacramento's current lead investigator, believes the two series are the work of the same offender. The FBI agrees. Contra Costa's lead investigator, Paul Holes, does not. An endomorph does not magically become an ectomorph, Holes is quick to observe. Orange County, 1996. Roger Harrington developed one belief that he maintained steadfastly, despite the uncomfortable implications. He was quoted in an October 1988 Orange Coast magazine story, 8 years after the murder of his son and daughter-in-law, as saying he was sure the motive lay somewhere in Patty's background, not Keith's. They'd been married only a few months. Patty seemed unassailable, but how much do they really know about her past? One detail made him certain the couple must have known the killer. The bedspread. The killer had taken the time to pull the cover over their heads. Whoever did it knew them and was sorry they'd done it, Roger told the magazine. In the old days, unsolved cases were solved by the unexpected phone call, the shrill ring of a rotary phone that signaled a deathbed confession or a tipster with verifiable facts. But the phone never rang for Keith and Patty Harrington or Manuela Whithune. Instead, the break came in the form of 3 glass tubes stored in manila envelopes that hadn't moved in 15 years. Few people could be expected to greet the news of a break with more enthusiasm than Roger Harrington. The blank face of his son's killer dominated huge, empty tracts of his mental map. The Orange Coast magazine profile about his search for Keith and Patty's killer ends with a grim, plain-spoken quote. "That's why I keep living. I don't want to go till I find out." The 3 tubes that advanced the mystery closer to an answer were opened and tested in October and November 1996. By December, results in hand, Orange County Sheriff's investigators were ready to make phone calls to the families. But Roger Harrington never learned the news. He'd died a year and a half earlier, on March 8, 1995. Had Roger lived, he would have learned more about the killer's history. He would have discovered that he was wrong about why his son and daughter-in-law's heads had been covered with the bedspread. It wasn't remorse. The last time the killer bludgeoned a couple to death, it had been messy. He didn't want Keith and Patty's blood on him. One Sunday morning in 1962, a British paperboy found a dead cat on the side of the road. The 12-year-old put the cat in his bag and brought it home with him. This was in Luton, a town 30 miles north of London. With some time to kill before lunch, the boy placed the cat on the dining room table and began to dissect it with a homemade kit, which included a scalpel fashioned from a flattened pin. A foul odor spread through the house, displeasing the boy's family. Had the cat been alive when it was eviscerated, this anecdote might belong to Ted Bundy's life story. As it happens, the boy in question, a budding scientist, would become serial killer's biggest adversary, the creator of their kryptonite. His name is Alec Jeffries. In September 1984, Jeffries discovered DNA fingerprinting. In doing so, he changed forensic science and criminal justice forever. The first generation of DNA technology compared to current technique is like the difference between a Commodore 64 computer and a smartphone. When the Orange County Crime Lab began incorporating DNA testing in the early 1990s, it would take up to 4 weeks for a criminalist to work one case. The biological sample being tested needed to be sizable, a blood stain the size of a quarter, for example, and in good shape. Now, a smattering of skin cells can reveal someone's genetic fingerprint in a matter of hours. The DNA Identification Act of 1994 established the FBI's authority to maintain a national database, and CODIS, Combined DNA Index System, was born. The best way to explain how CODIS operates today is to imagine it as the top of a vast forensic science pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid are hundreds of local crime labs throughout the country. The labs take unknown DNA samples from crime scenes, along with certain suspect samples that have been collected, and input them into their state databases. In California, the inputted samples are automatically uploaded every Tuesday. The state is also responsible for DNA collection from jails and courthouses. State databases then take all the collected samples and run them through a verification process and an intrastate comparison. After that, the samples are bumped up the national ladder to CODIS. Speedy. Efficient. Thorough. Not so in the mid-1990s, when the databases were first being developed. Crime labs relied then on RFLP, short for Restriction Fragment Length Polymorphism, analysis for DNA profiling, a laborious process that eventually went the way of the beeper. But the Orange County lab always had a reputation for being ahead of the pack. A December 20th, 1995 article in the Orange County Register, DA's Target, Ghosts of Murders Past, explained that local prosecutors, in coordination with detectives and criminalists, were for the first time submitting DNA evidence from old unsolved cases to the California Department of Justice's new lab in Berkeley, where 4,000 DNA profiles of known violent criminals, many of them sex offenders, were filed. California's DNA database was in its infancy, and Orange County was helping it grow. 6 months later, in June 1996, Orange County got its first cold hit, a match between crime scene DNA evidence and the DNA of a known felon in the database. The first cold hit was an extraordinary one. It identified a prison inmate named Gerald Parker as the serial killer of 5 women. A sixth victim of Parker's was pregnant and survived her attack, but her full-term fetus did not. The husband of the pregnant victim, whose injuries resulted in severe memory loss, had spent 16 years in prison for her attack. He was immediately exonerated. Parker was a month away from being released when the cold hit was made. The Orange County Sheriff's Department and crime lab staff was stunned. The first time they submit DNA to the fledgling state database, they solve six murders. It seemed that the weather in the property room, always an oppressive gray, had lifted, and light beamed down on the monotony of cardboard boxes. Old evidence had languished there for decades undisturbed. Each box was a time capsule. Fringed purse, embroidered tunic, items from lives defined by violent death. The unsolved section of a property room is tainted with disappointment. It's the to-do list that's never done. Now everyone basked in the possibilities. It was a heady feeling, the idea that one could conjure a man from a stain on a calico patchwork quilt from 1978, that one could reverse the flow of power. If you commit murder and then vanish, what you leave behind isn't just pain, but absence, a supreme blankness that triumphs over everything else. The unidentified murderer is always twisting a doorknob behind a door that never opens. But his power evaporates the moment we know him. We learn his banal secrets. We watch as he's led, shackled and sweaty, into a brightly lit courtroom as someone seated several feet higher peers down unsmiling, wraps a gavel, and speaks at long last every syllable of his birth name. Names. The sheriff's department needed names. The abandoned boxes in the property room were packed tight with stuff. Q-tip swabs preserved in tubes, underwear, cheap white sheets. Every inch of fabric and millimeter of cotton tip held promise. There were other possibilities besides making immediate arrests. DNA profiles that were developed from evidence might not match a known felon in the database, but profiles from different cases might match each other, uncovering a serial killer. That information could focus an investigation, energize it. They had to get going. The crime lab staff crunched the numbers. Between 1972 and 1994, Orange County investigated 2,479 homicides and cleared 1,591. Leaving nearly 900 unsolved cases. A strategy was developed for re-examining cold cases. Homicides involving sexual assaults would be prioritized, as those killers tend to be repeat offenders and leave behind the kind of biological material that lends itself to DNA typing. Mary Hong was one of the criminalists tasked with concentrating on cold cases. Jim White took her aside. 15 years later, he hadn't forgotten his old suspicion. Harrington, he said. Whittune. The names didn't mean anything to Hong, who hadn't worked at the lab at the time of the murders. White encouraged her to prioritize those two cases. I always thought it was the same guy, he told her. A brief, non-technical explanation of DNA typing might be helpful. DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, is the molecular sequence that defines each human being as unique. Every cell in your body, except red blood cells, has a nucleus that contains your DNA. A forensic scientist working to develop a genetic profile will first extract available DNA from a biological sample, semen, blood, hair, then isolate, amplify, and analyze it. DNA consists of four repeating units, and it's the precise sequence of the units that differentiates us from one another. Think of it as a human barcode. The numbers on the barcode represent genetic markers. In the early days of DNA typing, only a few markers could be developed and analyzed. Today, there are 13 standard CODIS markers. The likelihood of any two individuals, except identical twins, having the same human barcode is roughly 1 in 1 billion. In late 1996, when Mary Hong went to retrieve the Harrington and Whittune rape kits from the property room, DNA typing was experiencing exciting changes. The traditional process, RIFLIP, was still used by the state database, but it required ample DNA that couldn't be degraded in any way. It wasn't ideal for cold cases. But the Orange County Crime Lab had recently integrated a new technique, PCR-STR, polymerase chain reaction with short tandem repeat analysis. which was much faster than RIFLIP and is the backbone of forensic testing today. The difference between RIFLIP and PCR-STR is like copying down numbers in longhand versus using a high-speed Xerox machine. PCR-STR worked particularly well for cold cases, in which DNA samples might be minuscule or degraded by time. One of the first examples of forensic science solving a murder appears in a book called The Washing Away of Wrongs, published in 1247 by Song Tsi, a Chinese coroner and detective. The author relates a story about a peasant found brutally hacked to death with a handsickle. The local magistrate, unable to make headway in the investigation, calls for all the village men to assemble outside with their sickles. They're instructed to place their sickles on the ground and then take a few steps back. The hot sun beats down. A buzz is heard. Metallic green flies descend in a chaotic swarm, and then, as if collectively alerted, land on one sickle, crawling all over it as the other sickles lie undisturbed. The magistrate knew traces of blood and human tissue attract blowflies. The owner of the fly-covered sickle hung his head in shame. The case was solved. Methods are no longer so rudimentary. Centrifuge and microscope have replaced insects. The unidentified male DNA that was extracted from the Harrington and Withune rape kits was subjected to the crime lab's most sensitive tools, restriction enzymes, fluorescent dyes, thermal cyclers. But forensic science advancements are really just about finding the latest way to draw a blowfly to a bloody sickle. The goal is the same as it was in 13th century rural China. Cellular certainty establishing guilt. Hong appeared in Jim White's doorway. He was at his desk. Harrington, she said. Withune. He looked up expectantly. Criminalists like Hong and White are methodical people. They have to be. Their work is always being torn apart by defense attorneys in court. They often keep their conclusions broad, blunt object, which can cause tension with cops, who accuse them of being too self-defensively cautious. Cops and criminalists need each other, but are temperamentally very different. Cops thrive on action. They are knee-jigglers with paper-strewn desks they avoid. They want to be out there. Bad guy behavior they know as muscle memory. If they approach a guy and he abruptly turns to the right, for instance, he's probably concealing a gun. They know which drug leaves burn marks on fingerprints, crack, and about how long someone can survive without a pulse, 4 minutes. They slog through chaos, inured to bullshit and squalor. The job inflicts lacerations. In turn, the cop becomes lacerating. At his most lacerating, when the darkness has gone through him like dye through water, he'll be called upon to comfort the parents of a dead girl. For some cops, the pivot from chaos to comfort becomes harder and harder to do, and they abandon the compassion part altogether. Criminalists orbit the chaos from a latex-sheathed remove. The crime lab is arid and rigorously maintained. There's no hard-edged banter. Cops wrestle up close with life's messiness. Criminalists quantify it. But they're also human beings. Details from cases they worked stay with them. Patty Harrington's baby blanket, for example. Even as an adult, she slept with the little white blanket every night, rubbing its silk edges for security. The baby blanket was found between her and Keith. Same guy, Hong said. Jim White allowed himself a smile before getting back to work. A few weeks later, as 1996 came to a close, Hong was at her desk scanning an Excel spreadsheet on her computer. The spreadsheet was a compilation of the 20 or so unsolved cases in which DNA profiles had been successfully developed. The chart cross-referenced case numbers and victims' names with the profiles, which consisted of 5 PCR loci, or markers, that were then in use for typing. For example, under the marker THO1, you might see the result 8, 7, and so forth. Hong knew the Harrington and Withune profiles matched. But as her eyes swept over the spreadsheet, another profile stopped her cold. She read over the sequence several times and compared it to Harrington and Withune to be certain. She wasn't imagining it. It was the same. The victim was an 18-year-old named Janelle Cruz, whose body had been discovered in her family's Irvine home on May 5, 1986. No one had ever proposed that Cruz could be connected to Harrington or Withune, even though Cruz lived in Northwood, the same subdivision as Withune, and their houses were just 2 miles apart. It wasn't just the 5-year-plus time span, or that Janelle was a decade younger than Patty Harrington and Manuela Wittune. She was different. Irvine, 1986. Editor's note. The following chapter was pieced together from Michelle's notes. The brief life of Janelle Cruz was no less tragic than her death. Her biological father was long out of the picture. She'd suffered a string of stepfathers and stand-ins, most of whom abused her in various ways. Her mother was more committed to partying and doing drugs than raising her. Or at least, that's how Janelle saw it. She moved around a lot, from New Jersey to Tustin to Lake Arrowhead to Newport Beach, and finally to Irvine. When she was 15, she was drugged and raped by the father of her best friend while at their house for a sleepover. Janelle told her family, and they confronted the man, who was a soldier at the nearby Marine base. He denied it. When Janelle's family pressed, he sicked some fellow soldiers on them to intimidate them into letting the matter drop. The crime went unreported. In the years that followed, Janelle began rebelling. She dressed in black. She withdrew. She started cutting herself. She used cocaine, less for recreational purposes than for weight loss. Her mother sent her away to various places, ranging from YMCA camp to Job Corps in Utah to a short-term psychiatric hospital. She earned her high school diploma from Job Corps and returned to Irvine, where she enrolled in classes at the local college while cultivating a rotating menu of sex partners, mostly men a few years her senior. She began working as a hostess for Bullwinkle's Restaurant, a Chuck E. Cheese-style family eatery named after the titular moose from Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends. Irvine's motto, goes the joke, is 16 zip codes, 6 floor plans. Or, Irvine, we have 62 words for beige. Janelle roved in her monochrome tract in a kind of fitful, searching daze. The jolt she sought, the love, never came. On May 3, 1986, her mother and stepfather left for a vacation to Cancun. The following evening, a male co-worker from Bullwinkle's hung out with Janelle after she told him she was lonely with her parents out of town. They sat on her bedroom floor. She read him some of her poems. His hopeful, romantic interest kept him there as she played a 45-minute tape recording of a counseling session in which she railed against her messed-up family. A noise outside, like a gate or door closing, startled them. Janelle peeked out her window and closed the shutters. "I think it's just the cats," Janelle said while peering through the window. Sometime later, the noise recurred, this time from the direction of the garage. Janelle again dismissed it. "It's just the washing machine." The teenage workmate, recalling that it was a school night, left a short time later. Janelle gave him a friendly hug goodbye. Linda Sheen, pseudonym, left her desk at Tarbell Realty on the afternoon of May 5th to visit a home in Irvine for a prospective buyer. The property, located at 13 Encina, was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, single-story house that had been on the market for several months. It was still inhabited by its owner, along with her 4 children, including 2 grown daughters, and her husband. It was a house that looked virtually indistinguishable from so many others in the Northwood community, including the one at 35 Columbus, a mile away, where a 29-year-old housewife had been bludgeoned to death in her bed 5 years earlier in an unsolved crime that was quickly forgotten. The house at 13 Encina backed up to a park and was the second-to-last house at the end of a cul-de-sac, sealed by a hedge wall with a break in the middle that led to undeveloped property that marked the end of civilization. Miles of orange groves and open fields insulated Northwood from nearby Tustin and Santa Ana. Only 10 years earlier, those same orange groves had tiled the land on which 13 Encina and its surrounding neighborhood now stood. 2 decades later, the remaining groves gave way almost completely to urbanization, with a mammoth strip mall and uniform housing developments paving the entire distance to those other cities. Sheen arrived at 13 Encina and rang the doorbell. Although there was a beige Chevette parked in the driveway, nothing inside the house stirred, so she rang again. Still silence, much like earlier in the afternoon when she'd phoned the home and received no answer. She proceeded to the lockbox and retrieved the key, letting herself in. She looked around and noticed that the dining room light was on. In the kitchen, a carton of milk stood on the breakfast table. A newspaper was open to the employment section. She put her business card on the dining table and walked to the family room, peering through the sliding glass door into the backyard. She saw several lawn chairs and a lounge chair with a towel draped over it. She went to the master bedroom and turned the doorknob, but it was locked. The second bedroom looked like that of a child, and as Sheen entered the last bedroom at the end of the hall, she saw the body of a young woman lying motionless in the bed, with a blanket covering her head. A jolt of fear surged through Linda Sheen. She felt she might not be alone in the house. She might be in the wrong place at the wrong time, seeing something she shouldn't be seeing. The woman appeared not to be sleeping, but either unconscious, perhaps from a drug overdose, or dead. Sheen bolted from 13 Encina and returned to her office, where she told her boss, Norm Prado, pseudonym, of her discovery. He told her to phone the residence again. She did. Twice. No one answered. Linda and Norm relayed the situation to colleagues Arthur Hoag and Carol Nosler, pseudonyms, at Century 21, which was handling the sale of the home. The pair skeptically swung by 13 Encina and entered to indeed find the body of a young woman, unquestionably dead. Hoag called the police and told them he found a young lady with her head caved in. Irvine PD officer Barry Aninog was the first to respond to the scene. As he entered the home, he was immediately approached by Arthur Hoag, who emerged from the kitchen and urgently reported, "There's a dead body in the bedroom. There's a dead body in the bedroom." He repeated this a few more times as Aninog made his way to the last bedroom down the hall. On the bed was the nude body of a young woman who would later be identified as Janelle Cruz. She was cold to the touch and had no pulse. The body was lying face up, with the chest and face covered by a blanket that featured a large, dark stain over where the victim's head would probably be. Aninog slowly peeled away the blanket that was stubbornly adhering to the victim's face, revealing a massive wound to her forehead, bruising on her nose, and a veritable mask of blood. Three of her teeth had been knocked out. Two of them were found in her hair. Between her legs were flakes of dried fluid, which lab analysis would reveal to be semen. Tufts of blue fibers were found on her body, suggesting that a fabric had been ripped apart by someone as they stood over her. Tennis shoe prints were found on the east side of the house. No ligatures or weapons were found at the scene. A heavy red pipe wrench that had been in the backyard was missing, it was later determined. Police canvassing the neighborhood gleaned little in the way of useful leads. A door-to-door solicitor from a window-washing company had been passing out yellow flyers the night before the murder. A neighborhood kid said he'd heard the girl at 13 Encina had been beaten to death and alerted the cops to a broken baseball bat he spotted in a nearby field. They followed him to the site. A snail oozed its way across the surface of the bat, which was mostly intact. Grass was growing on it. Clearly it had been languishing there for some time. One neighbor heard Janelle's Chevette, with its distinctively loud muffler, pulling in at around 11:15 p.m., about half an hour after her co-worker would have left the residence. He heard the engine turn off and one of the doors slam shut. At 4 a.m. and 5:30 a.m. that morning, two different neighbors respectively observed an inordinate amount of light emanating from the residence. Janelle's sister, Michelle, was vacationing in Mammoth when she received the call. "Janelle has been murdered." The connection was not pristine. Michelle repeated what she thought she heard in utter disbelief. "Janelle got married?" The words were clearer the second time around. Lead investigator Larry Montgomery and his colleagues began scrutinizing Janelle's activities, uncovering a litany of young men who wandered through her life in the days before her murder. There was Randy Gill, pseudonym, from YMCA camp, who'd been having sex with Janelle and phoned her the night she was killed. He reputedly had a drinking problem. Janelle broke up with him 2 weeks before her murder. There was Martin Gomez, pseudonym, an ex-convict who met Janelle at a previous workplace and eased into a sexual relationship with her that she eventually broke off after he became obsessive and controlling. And Philip Michaels, pseudonym, a lifeguard Janelle had just begun dating, who hung out with her the day before she was murdered. He was also sleeping with Janelle, though he initially denied it. And then the Davids. David Decker, pseudonym, who met Janelle at the YMCA camp when he was a counselor and she was a camper, and had last seen her 2 days before she died. David Thompson, pseudonym, not to be confused with Ron Thompson, the last boy to see her alive, who also worked with her at Bullwinkle's, and Dave Kowalski, pseudonym, another boyfriend, who had visited Janelle at her home the day of her death and told her he loved her. He gave her a Seiko wristwatch as a token of his feelings. It was found next to her body. There were also the weirdos and outliers like Bruce Wendt, pseudonym, an oddball who'd been to Janelle's house shortly before the murder. His entry in Janelle's address book was accompanied by a handwritten notation. Fuckhead, jerk, asshole, faggot. And then there was the one who confessed. Tom Hickel, pseudonym, was in his van driving home from the movies with his friend Mike Martinez, pseudonym, in the passenger seat. Midway through the drive, Martinez suddenly turned to him and said, "I have to get something off of my chest." Hickel didn't brace himself hard enough for what followed. "I killed her." Martinez spoke as if unloading a burden. "I killed Janelle." He looked dead serious. "You know that steel thing I have?" "I don't know what steel thing you're talking about," Hickel replied. "Never mind," Martinez continued. "I just wanted to see if I had the guts to kill. It started in the bathroom, and I fought with her first. I hit her with this steel thing." Hickel asked him how it felt. Martinez told him, "It feels like nothing. It feels normal." Hickel tried to hide his goosebumps. "I wanted to know if I had the guts to kill Jennifer," Martinez explained. Jennifer, not her real name, was his girlfriend. "I don't care if I'm put in jail for 25 years. They don't have the death penalty here. I killed Janelle, and I will pay for it." Martinez told Hickel that he'd been over Janelle's house the week before she died. He met her parents. He learned they were going to be out of town, and Janelle would be home alone. "I purchased a single-shot shotgun from Big Five," Martinez confided. "I'm going to use it to blow Jenny away, because she needs to die." Hickel continued trying his damnedest to not react. "I'll turn myself into the cops after I do it," he promised. "I'm going to do it on Saturday." He didn't say which Saturday. Before they parted ways, Martinez told Hickel that he was just kidding about killing Janelle. "I just wanted to see what you'd do." What Hickel did was, he went to the police, to whom Mike Martinez was certainly no stranger. He had prior arrests for attempted marijuana possession, commercial burglary, residential burglary, assault and battery, and he had twice attempted suicide, once by drinking Drano. The residential burglary charge and one of the assault and battery charges stemmed from an incident with Jenny, the girlfriend Martinez intended to kill. And it turned out, Martinez repeated this sequence of crimes, the very night before Janelle was murdered. At 1 a.m., Martinez drunkenly broke into Jennifer's apartment through the sliding glass door and confronted her, demanding to know why she'd ignored him when they'd crossed paths at a Carl's Jr. a week before. With glazed eyes and unsteady footing, Martinez professed his love for Jennifer, and in the same breath attacked her religious beliefs. She pleaded with him to leave. He ignored her. His blank expression betrayed no evidence that he even heard her talking to him. "Why didn't you call me?" he kept asking. He then left the room. Thinking he was gone, Jennifer cautiously proceeded downstairs, only to find Martinez in the kitchen. He had a kitchen knife and was cutting a towel into strips. Anticipating that he was about to tie her up, she began screaming. He grabbed her and muzzled her with his hand, dragging her into the bedroom and onto the bed. She screamed and fought, driving him out of the apartment. But only for a moment. When he returned to look for his keys, Jennifer resumed screaming, ordering him to leave. He knocked her against the couch and punched her twice in the mouth and once in the head. Finally, he left for good. On June 21st, Mike Martinez was arrested near his home in Garden Grove. In the police cruiser en route to the station, Martinez insisted, "I would have turned myself in. Tom set me up. I didn't do it. It's not fair. Why me?" He began ranting. "Do you guys have enough evidence right now to put me away or what? I don't think you do because I have not seen Janelle in 3 years. "You probably have enough evidence anyways," Martinez continued. "So I'm Mexican. I don't have any money. I can't afford an attorney. I'll get a public defender. He's going to tell me to settle for 15 or 25 years. I'm probably going to get first-degree murder premeditated. That's going to be 25 years. What are you going to charge me with anyway? First degree or second degree? It's not fair. Why did you pick me up?" A tape recorder was running. The cops let him ramble. He'd dig his own grave. Okay, I'm in this situation. Is it something that... It fully looks like first-degree premeditated, doesn't it? A lot of people that are innocent, mostly niggers and Mexicans like myself, are going to take the fall. You should at least take blood. Find out I'm innocent, eventually catch the real guy. If I'm innocent, can I sue Tom? I don't think I'm going to get out of it either. I think that Montgomery is just going to use what he has, and that is going to be enough. Once at the station, a technician from Gold Coast Laboratories took Martinez's blood. A CSI officer assisted in collecting hair samples. Early in July, the lab results from Michael Martinez's blood sample were returned to Montgomery. Martinez was eliminated as a suspect. The co-worker was eliminated, too. DNA profiling was still a year away from its debut appearance on the forensic landscape, but advances in serology, the study of serum and other bodily fluids, provided investigators with some insights. Janelle's killer possessed a rare genetic makeup. He was a non-secretor, an individual who doesn't secrete blood group antigens in other bodily fluids like saliva, semen, etc. Non-secretors make up about 20% of the population. His PGM, phosphoglycerate mutase, a protein enzyme, was also an unusual type. An Orange County crime lab forensic scientist informed a Cruz investigator that the killer's combination of non-secretor and PGM type is seen in approximately 1% of the population. It wouldn't influence his physical appearance. His health and behavior wouldn't be affected. He simply possessed rare markers. Investigators appreciated the forensic results, but they needed a face and name. They felt certain the answer was in Janelle's immediate orbit. The theory persisted that one of the young men in her life was responsible. 10 years later, Martinez and all the other boyfriends and guy pals who drifted into Janelle's circle were conclusively eliminated when the DNA profile of her killer was developed. It matched none of the original suspects. Instead, it matched an unidentified killer responsible for 3 other murders. Mary Hong has a scientist's dispassion and isn't easily shocked, but the Harrington-Whithune-Cruz match dented her composure. She stared wide-eyed at the spreadsheet. "That's unbelievable," she said to her computer screen. Ventura, 1980. The sheriff's department formed a special cold case unit to deal with the sudden influx of new leads. Members of the countywide law enforcement unsolved element, known as CLUE, began digging through old case files in January 1997. Meanwhile, Mary Hong faxed the Harrington-Whithune-Cruz DNA profile to hundreds of crime labs throughout the country. There was no response. Investigator Larry Poole transferred into CLUE from the Sex Crimes Unit in February 1998. Poole is an Air Force vet with a stiff bearing. His moral perspective lacks gray. He loves God and abhors cursing. When cops are asked about their favorite part of the job, most reminisce about times they got to work undercover. The adrenaline that comes with unleashing your dodgy id with no idea of what's coming around the corner. Poole never worked undercover. It's hard to imagine that he ever could. He once interrogated a serial killer on death row in another state about a missing woman in Southern California police suspected him of killing. Poole suggested that the killer tell him where to find the body. It was the right thing to do. For his conscience, for the woman's family. The killer began mild negotiations, remarking about the better conditions in California prisons. Maybe a transfer could be negotiated in exchange for information? Poole organized his paperwork and stood from the table. "You'll die here," he said, and walked out the door. Cold cases suited him. They were blanks that edgier cops, the ones itching to kick in a door, might never fill in. Poole could. He was an insomniac who liked to launch a command in his brain, mull an investigative challenge in the background of his mind, until sometime later, maybe brushing his teeth or getting into his car, an answer came to him. Streetwise cops could sit down with a father who'd just set his family on fire and talk with him as though they were buddies sharing beers at a baseball game. They'd accept a degree of moral ambiguity, or at least pretend they did. For someone like Poole, who couldn't fake it, cold cases were perfect. He was a 12-year veteran at the sheriff's department, but relatively fresh at homicide investigation. A cardboard box containing 3 cases, Harrington, Whithune, and Cruz, was his new assignment. Inside were four stolen lives, one featureless monster. Poole told himself he would launch commands until he found him. Poole noticed a Ventura Police Department case number scribbled in the margin of one of the reports in the Harrington file. He called and inquired. That's the Lyman and Charlene Smith murders, he was told. Notorious case in Ventura. Lyman was a well-known attorney. He was on the verge of a superior court judgeship. Charlene was his knockout former secretary turned second wife. On Sunday, March 16th, 1980, Gary Smith, Lyman's 12-year-old son from his first marriage, biked over to his father's house to mow the lawn. The front door was unlocked. An alarm clock buzzing drew him tentatively to the master bedroom. Bark fragments were scattered across the gold carpet. A narrow log lay at the foot of the bed. Two shapes under the covers were the bodies of his father and stepmother. Investigators were deluged with leads. The Smiths' hilltop home overlooking Ventura Harbor was a slick sheen obscuring instability and drama. Affairs. Less than squeaky clean business deals. They quickly zeroed in on a friend and former business partner of Lyman's named Joe Alsip. Alsip had visited the Smiths the night before their murders. His fingerprint was on a wine goblet. Worse, his minister told police that Alsip had essentially confessed to him. Alsip was arrested. The police and prosecution entered the preliminary hearing braying with confidence. They were especially pleased to see that Alsip's defense attorney was Richard Hanawalt. Hanawalt was best known to them for successfully defending drunk drivers. He was partial to mixed metaphors and non sequiturs. Briefly during the lunch hour, I wondered what the definition of strong was, he announced to the Alsip courtroom one day. About the opposing narratives in the case, he said, little by little it begins to unroll like a long carpet in front of a hotel. What they thought were Hanawalt's fumbling antics hit a bombshell. Anonymous tipsters had encouraged him to investigate the minister's past. He found a decades-long history, spanning the country from Indiana to Washington, of the minister bizarrely seeking police protection and trying to insert himself into investigations. Sergeant Gary Adkinson, one of the lead investigators on the Smith case, had quietly anticipated the minister's unraveling and cringed when Hanawalt gleefully began to dismantle his story. The chief had given the minister a police radio after he insisted that he'd received threats on his life after turning in Alsip. One afternoon, the minister's terrified voice came panting over the radio. "He's here! He's coming at me!" he shouted. Adkinson happened to be at the intersection of Telegraph and Victoria, just a block from the minister's house, and he raced over. The minister stood inside the front door, holding the radio dumbly to his chest, looking devastated to see Adkinson so soon. "He's gone," he said quietly. In his closing argument, Hanawalt also succeeded in painting the crime scene as an eerie tableau that felt like the work of a stranger psychopath rather than someone known to the Smiths. There was the binding with drapery cord, the devastating blows to their heads with the log, the lack of any lights on in the house, which suggested that the violent encounter may have happened in complete darkness. And the bathroom window. Someone standing there had a clear view into the bedroom. A few yards from the window was the firewood pile, where the killer grabbed the 21-inch piece of wood. After the preliminary hearing, the Ventura County District Attorney released Joe Alsip for lack of evidence. The investigative team returned to square one. They were split. Half thought the killer knew the Smiths, the other half thought it was a random, sexually motivated crime. For years, the Smith file sat on a shelf in the investigator's bullpen. After a decade, it was relegated to the evidence vault. Larry Poole explained to Ventura PD that the Orange County Sheriff's Department had an unsolved serial case involving four homicide victims that bore similarities to that of the Smiths. He asked them to send any forensic evidence they still had on Smith over to the Orange County Crime Lab. Mary Hong opened the Ventura PD package. Inside were a couple of glass slides. Her heart sank. Q-tip swabs that are routinely taken as part of a rape kit are rubbed against glass slides, as the slides make it easier to look for sperm under a microscope. But usually the swabs are included in the kit, too. A criminalist is always looking to work with as much biological material as possible. On February 17, 1998, Poole received Hong's report. She'd been able to develop a DNA profile from the semen on the slides. Lyman Smith could be eliminated as the source. The DNA profile matched the Harrington, Whithune, and Cruz profiles. Some of the old guard at the Ventura PD refused to believe it. Detective Russ Hayes, one of the leads on the Smith case, was interviewed for an episode of Cold Case Files that aired some years later.
"I think you could have knocked me over with a feather," he recalled about the DNA connection.
The old-timer's distrust of technology had him shaking his head.
"I couldn't believe it," Hayes said. "Didn't believe it."
Hayes recalled his theory that the killer stood outside the bathroom window at the north side of the house, the portal through which he could see Lyman and Charlene's bedroom, and became enraged at something he saw. An act of intimacy, most likely.
"I thought that it was someone close to them. I thought it was someone who had seen something through that window, looking into the bedroom. And it just infuriated them, causing them to go inside and do what they did."
Hayes was probably right about the position outside the window. And the rage. But not the familiarity. Charlene Smith was just the latest unlucky stand-in for the lustful, sneering women, mother, schoolgirl, ex-wife, who formed a disapproving circle around the killer in his daydreams, their cacophony of disdain forcing him always to his knees. The act of grabbing the log was arousal, alchemized to hate, a vicious punishment meted out by one judge, his corroded brain. The body count stood at 6. Nearly 20 years too late, they were learning his methods, how he adapted, and that he was mobile. Mapping the crimes took on a contagion-like feel, a search for victim zero. Where was he before Ventura? Someone dug up the old newspaper articles, the ones questioning whether not only Ventura and Orange were connected, but Santa Barbara, too. "Double murders may be linked, police say," read the headline in the July 30th, 1981 edition of the Santa Ana Register. Nearly 20 years later, the three counties compared information again. There were a few dissimilarities. Two of the male Santa Barbara victims had been shot when it appeared they fought back. But too many parallels existed to discount a link. Prowling and peeping. Nighttime attacks on middle-class victims who were sleeping. Bludgeoning. Pre-cut ligatures brought to the scene. Tennis shoe impressions. Many aspects that were present in a pair of double murders in a town 40 miles north. Editor's note. The Ventura investigation was unquestionably the most labyrinthine of all the standalone investigations. Michelle had planned to cover it at great length, but Ventura is only lightly represented in the book due to her protracted quest to obtain the highly elusive case file. In 2014, Michelle paid the Ventura County Courthouse $1,400 for hard copies of the transcripts from the Joe Alsip preliminary hearings. All 2,806 pages had to be printed for microfilm. Michelle later recalled the clerk eyeing her with some cocktail of confusion and derision as she handed Michelle the massive volume of freshly printed archive material. Reading the transcripts, which were full of tantalizing allusions to items more fully documented in the official reports, only made Michelle covet the Ventura file that much more. In January 2016, she finally got her hands on the file when she borrowed 3 dozen boxes of Golden State Killer material from the Orange County Sheriff's Department. She had read through much of that file, which primarily focused on red herring Joe Alsip, by the time of her death, but she did not have time to weave it into the narrative. For a more complete account of the Smith investigation and the case against Joe Alsip, Colleen Kaysen's series, The Silent Witness, published in the Ventura County Star in November 2002, is an excellent reference. Goleta, 1979. Editor's note. Segments of the following chapter have been pieced together from various drafts of In the Footsteps of a Killer, a piece Michelle wrote for Los Angeles Magazine, originally published in February 2013, and later supplemented online. The man approached Linda, not her real name, as she was leaving for work in the morning.
"My dog was stabbed in your backyard last night," he said.
The man was young, in his early 20s, elfin-featured and a little hyperactive. He pointed to the footbridge that crossed the creek about 200 feet from where they stood on Berkeley Road in Goleta. He and his dog Chemo had come from there, he explained, Chemo off-leash and the man lagging casually behind. The city of Goleta is a bedroom community with a safe reputation, boring even. But few people would brave San Jose Creek alone at night. The narrow gorge winds down from the chaparral-covered mountains through the east side of town and is shrouded in huge draping trees, sycamore, alder, and eucalyptus, with its papery, cracked bark that looks clawed at. There are no lights, and the only sounds are the clump and rustling of unseen animals seeking food. But Kimo was a big, protective dog, a 120-pound German Shepherd and Alaskan Malamute mix. That something might happen to the dog never occurred to the man. When he exited the footbridge into the residential neighborhood, he saw Kimo dart between Linda's house and her next-door neighbors. Something must have drawn his attention back there. Kimo was nosy. From the man's vantage point, the 5400 block of Berkeley Road was still. Up until the 1960s, Goleta was a sea of walnut groves and lemon orchards, and in certain pockets, especially adjacent to the creek, you could experience what it must have been like back then. No engines revving, no electronics humming. There was just a blanketing, hushed darkness and a scattering of lights from single-story ranch houses. A surfboard atop a VW bus in someone's driveway was the only reminder that this was Southern California suburbia in early fall 1979. A sharp yelp broke the silence. Moments later, Kimo reappeared. The dog made his way unsteadily to the sidewalk and collapsed at the man's feet. The man turned him over. Blood oozed from a long cut to his belly. Kimo survived. After frantically knocking at several houses, the man was finally able to find a phone and called for help. An urgent care veterinarian closed the wound with 70 stitches, leaving a scar that stretched from Kimo's sternum to the end of his belly. But the man remained puzzled about the source of the injury. Linda understood. Work could wait. She enlisted the help of her next-door neighbor, and together the three of them carefully scoured the side and backyards for sharp objects, like a lawnmower blade or piece of torn fence which might have cut the dog. They found nothing. It was strange. Also odd was Linda's flooded front lawn. Around the same time Kimo was hurt, someone had apparently turned on her hose and left it running. Linda never learned the dog owner's name. He thanked her politely and left. She mostly forgot about the incident until another man approached her outside her house with a question in July 1981. A lot had changed in the year and a half since Kimo was injured. Yellow crime scene tape had gone up 3 times in the neighborhood, unusual for an area so small, less than 2 square miles. And so homey that deputies affectionately nicknamed the teenagers they regularly ran out of the avocado groves for smoking weed, the Red Eye Gang. This was Santa Barbara County, home to President Reagan's 688-acre vacation ranch, and also a popular retreat for moneyed dilettantes with a hippie bent, where you could wear flip-flops all day or play act in a staged rodeo, where you could enjoy historically preserved Spanish architecture unsullied by garish billboards, a ban won after a multi-year campaign waged by aesthetically inclined civic leaders. From 1950 until 1991, the only stops on Highway 101 between an otherwise open 435 miles from Los Angeles to San Francisco were 4 traffic lights in Santa Barbara. Depending on whom you believe, this was because locals feared that a freeway would block their ocean view, or because they wanted tourists to patronize local businesses, or because they felt people should be encouraged to pause and contemplate life. And what better place to do this than in Santa Barbara, America's Riviera, ensconced between a rugged mountain range and the Pacific Ocean? Who didn't want to idle at a stoplight in paradise? The answer, eventually, was no one. The accidents were legion, weekend traffic was a gridlock, and pollution from idling cars became immense. Investigators felt they knew the night he learned he had to be careful. They knew the night that changed him. The first crime they could connect him to, where their rewinding stopped. October 1st, 1979. Less than a week after Kimo was stabbed. That was the night a Goleta couple on Queen Anne Lane awakened to a blinding flashlight and a young man's clenched teeth whisper. The woman was ordered to tie up her boyfriend. Then the intruder tied her. He rummaged around, opening and slamming drawers, cursing, threatening, asking for money but not focused on it. He led the woman into the living room and made her lie face down on the floor, throwing a pair of tennis shorts over her head as a blindfold. She heard him enter their kitchen. She heard him chanting to himself, "I'll kill him. I'll kill him. I'll kill him." A surge of adrenaline allowed the woman to escape her bindings and flee out the front door screaming. Her boyfriend, bound in the bedroom, was able to hop into the backyard. When he heard the intruder coming, he dropped and rolled behind an orange tree, narrowly eluding the searching beam of the flashlight. The couple's next-door neighbor